United Nations did express its concern for the escalation of the conflict, but protesters here say it's not enough.
We gathered in front of the UN office to say that all of the crimes that are being committed against civilians are happening because the United Nations has given the Saudi criminals a green light by staying silent and watching.
For 7 years, the Yemeni nation has been facing the cruelest blockade and deadliest airstrikes, but no one is doing anything to help the Yemenis.
This time, besides targeting innocent people, Saudi Arabia also targeted the internet infrastructure to prevent their crimes from being reflected to the world. So we are the voices of our Yemeni brothers and sisters, and we are here to tell the world about the Saudi crimes.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched the war on Yemen in March 2015, with the goal of bringing former Yemeni President Abdurrabbuh Mansur Hadi back to power. Yemen's Ansarullah movement, along with the army, leads the anti-Saudi resistance in the country. These people say, despite Riyadh's strong logistic support from the US and UK, Yemen has made headways against the Saudi invaders and left the kingdom and its allies bogged down in the country.
The enemy is facing a hard time. Saudi Arabia tried its best and plundered its money on American and British weapons to bring our nation to its knees. But our resistance has burst their bubble, and as you see, they are resorting to barbaric ways to achieve their evil goals. But we keep resisting until our land is free.
The ongoing bombardment of civilian facilities has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and destroyed the infrastructure of the impoverished country, not to mention the spread of infectious diseases and famine. Saudi Arabia has also imposed an all-out blockade against Yemen, which blocks the entry of humanitarian and medical supplies into the war-torn country.
The Saudi war on Yemen is slammed here as a crime against humanity, a crime that these people say continues to be ignored by the responsible entities in the world. Protesters here say it's time for the UN to do more than condemning the crimes committed by Riyadh and take action to bring the Yemeni suffering to an end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Harsh winter, hunger, and poverty have impacted daily lives across Afghanistan, with children worst hit by the difficulties combined with malnourishment and famine. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, more than 1 million children in Afghanistan are at the risk of severe malnutrition and death this year. The agency called on Afghan partners and donors to take practical steps to prevent the catastrophe.
We work here to provide our family with food and money. My father is alive, but he is jobless. Some of us are orphans and sole breadwinners of our families. It is very cold, but we have to come here and work.
It is cold, but we take to the streets for work. We polish boots or sell gum and flowers. I have a family of five. Me and my brother are our family's breadwinners. We have no way out.
Here in Indira Gandhi Hospital, as the doctors say, the number of malnourished children has more than doubled since poverty is on the rise in Afghanistan.
Malnutrition has a direct relation with the economic and financial situation of the people. The more people get poor, the more our patients increase. As you know, the recent sanctions and aid cut have affected our people's economy, so we are receiving more and more patients.
The economic situation has worsened among all Afghan children. Our children are being malnourished due to the shortage of food and nutrition in our country. I call on the world to help Afghan families.
According to the UN, only 2% of the population of Afghanistan are getting enough food to eat, and half the population are facing severe hunger. Almost 5 months after the US-led international coalition hastily abandoned Afghanistan, millions of Afghans are teetering at the brink of starvation. The US and its allies have cut off Afghanistan's access to international aid and froze roughly $10 billion in assets belonging to the country's central bank since August after the Taliban took over of the war-torn country. The UN had already warned that millions of Afghans could run out of food before the onset of harsh winter, and around 1 million children were at risk of starvation and death. 20 years of war and the US sanctions have led millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Children in particular are paying the price of conflicts and crises in their country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The past 12 months have been one of the most dangerous for refugees attempting to make the perilous cross-channel journey to the UK, with scores losing their lives en route. This has not halted the most determined, and despite the recent charges against 11 refugees who were prosecuted for steering small boats across the English Channel being dropped, campaigners say the Crown Prosecution Service needs to alter its policy of pursuing these cases in the first place.
These continued prosecutions are both racist and unlawful, and they're being pursued because of the political agenda of the Home Office, not justice and not the law. All of the prosecutions that are currently taking place will be quashed because it is unlawful. So the CPS need to drop all of these prosecutions now.
Home Secretary Priti Patel has described the proposed Nationality and Borders Bill as the biggest overhaul of the UK's asylum system in decades. But campaigners say it's not the job of the CPS to do the government's bidding.
It's not the CPS's business to be sending messages, political messages, for this government and the Home Office. The CPS should be interested in upholding the law, and the law at the current time says it is not unlawful to seek asylum. They can't prosecute people for a law that has not yet been passed.
The Conservatives are making life for refugees as unwelcoming as possible in this country. And as a part of the government's hostile environment policy, those who are looking to start over in the UK are having to jump through more complicated hoops. This means those who may steer the vessels used to help in the crossings. The CPS has previously said it only targets those who are repeat offenders or have engaged in other criminality.
The CPS have a responsibility. They're supposed to prosecute what is in public interest. This is not in public interest. This is in the interest of a government trying to save itself by utilising racism and anti-immigrant bigotry to drive on its other policies.
Campaigners now hope those facing charges associated with helping refugees will have those charges dropped and leave the CPS free to pursue genuine criminals. Amina Taylor, London.
The political stalemate continues. On Tuesday, also a second round of voting to elect Italy's President of the Republic proved inconclusive, with a vast majority of the 1,009 grand electors casting blank ballots, as they did in Monday's first round. Italian political parties have so far failed to find an agreement on a consensus candidate. Meetings between party leaders have continued behind the scenes, and although current Prime Minister Mario Draghi remains the most likely contender, a deal on the figure that unites the country is still far from being reached.
Prime Minister Draghi is reportedly trying to persuade political leaders to support his candidacy as Italy's next president. However, a large number of lawmakers oppose this idea, fearing that if Draghi is elected head of state, it could lead to early elections.
We think that President Draghi have to stay at Palazzo Chigi and to continue to do the prime minister, because if President Draghi move to the Quirinale, it's really difficult to find another person like Draghi to continue the work in the government.
Also on Tuesday, the rightist alliance made up of the League, Brothers of Italy and Forza Italia proposed three possible presidential candidates. The League leader Matteo Salvini has repeatedly warned that if Draghi leaves the role of prime minister, the multi-party ruling coalition would likely split, raising the risk of snap elections.
Non siamo qui a imporre.
We are not here to impose anything on anybody. In the last 30 years, the president has always been named by centre-left parties. We hope the names we are proposing are received with a willingness to discuss them.
It is very unlikely that a new president will be elected before Thursday. A majority of two-thirds of the grand electors is needed to vote in a new head of state in the first three ballots from the fourth round. So as of Thursday, an absolute majority would be sufficient. Max Civili, Rome.
Oh, France is starting their election season, but the issue of purchasing power has pushed a much longer-running problem out of the campaign, unemployment. France's army of unemployed were the first social group to be hurt by the coronavirus lockdowns, and they'll be the last to enjoy the recovery. The nation's top religious charities compiled a report, The Words of the Unemployed, to show the cruelty of adding harsh social judgments to economic and personal distress.
To suddenly find oneself without a job is to suddenly find yourself quite isolated. The lack of regular social contact makes immediate impact, and it's difficult to find one inner dynamism again. The COVID lockdowns have made isolation for the unemployed even more total, as interviews are conducted only over the internet or on the telephone. And this can be even more discouraging and anxiety-provoking for job seekers.
The report and the unemployed strongly encourage spending tax money and time on collectives, associations, and social groupings which give the jobless a place for regular human contact, discussions, and the chance to work with people again on worthwhile projects.
A whopping 60% of the unemployed say their biggest obstacle in returning to the workforce is a lack of decent jobs. They report scores of competitors for every single job opening in their field. It's a complaint of frustration which has been heard often ever since the age of austerity started.
Since 2008, French unemployment has risen over 30%. Today, top French economists put the real unemployment rate at over 20%, as part-time work has exploded in a country where it used to be almost non-existent.
My real-world job experiences too often get minimized by employers because I have periods of part-time work in my profession, or because I've had to work outside my field only occasionally, and I don't understand that point of view. What's vital for unemployed people is to have state job center counselors who aren't burdened with too many cases and who can give unemployed people time and attention. Counselors need to learn about the industry or field the person wants to work in to find them a proper long-term solution.
The unemployed say they aren't listened to, but talked down to, typified by President Emmanuel Macron's 2018 instructions to an actual job seeker that he could merely cross the street and find a job. In almost 5 years, Macron's neoliberal revolution has provoked massively repressed social protests, but only barely reduced unemployment from its all-time high in 2017 of 6.3 million people. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
application on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's opponents fall short of securing enough signatures to trigger a recall vote against him. The bid needed 4.2 million signatures, but garnered roughly 42,500. Venezuela plunged into political turmoil after the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure and former president of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Later, Guaido launched a botched coup to oust Maduro with Washington's green light and help from a small number of rogue soldiers. Venezuela's National Assembly president now has rejected calls for a dialogue with the U.S.-backed opposition as hypocritical, as long as Washington maintains pressure on Caracas, including asset freezes and sanctions. Joining us on Spotlight, We have Latin America correspondent Camila Escalante, who's with us from La Paz. Camila, welcome to the program. Talk to us about what went wrong for the opposition here.
Well, they spoke a lot on social media about the potential to hold a recall referendum against the mandate of President Nicolas Maduro. But in the end, the leaders or the figures of the opposition, mostly the far-right opposition, most aligned with Washington, didn't really do their job in promoting that to the people who are supposed to be their bases. In fact, Juan Guaido was one of the people who on social media, probably about a year ago, some time ago, said that he would back such a mechanism to try to remove the president. What's interesting is that in doing so, he, of course, gives legitimacy to the presidency that he says is illegitimate, because you can only use that mechanism to remove a sitting president, which he says, of course, that President Maduro is not the constitutional president, and that he is, and he's continuing on with that charade. The National Electoral Council, the Electoral Authority, said that with the number of votes or signatures that they were receiving in support of this recall referendum, they would need to be receiving signatures for a period of about 100 days to receive the necessary required signatures. And in reality, this mechanism is to be used, and you're supposed to be collecting the signatures and the support needed to hold it within just a few days. So there was no possible way that they were going to collect the necessary minimum to hold this recall referendum.
All right, thanks a lot for the update. That was Latin America correspondent Camila Escalante joining us from La Paz, but also joining us on Spotlight. We have lawyer, writer, and historian and former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred Desaias joining us from Geneva. And we also have author and journalist Arnold August joining us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Alfred Desaias from Geneva. Mr. Desaias, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us. What does this failure in garnering the necessary voter registry mean for the opposition?
Well, I think it was entirely predictable. They didn't do the footwork in order to get the votes, rather in order to get the signatures. So it was obviously inadmissible because they did not satisfy the provisions of this recall referendum procedure. By the way, it has been used in the past. You may recall that in 2002, the United States organized a coup d'etat against Hugo Chavez, and that one failed, lasted 48 hours, and in the intervening period, 2002 to 2004, the opposition tried all sorts of things to topple Chavez unsuccessfully. And then finally, there was a recall referendum in 2004, and that went 59% for Chavez. So this recall referendum procedure is a genuine procedure. But of course, you must get the minimum number of signatures if you want it through. As you know, I am not only an American citizen, I'm also a Swiss citizen. And here in Switzerland, we have a procedure of referenda and a procedure of individual legislative initiative, so that if you do collect, say, 500,000 signatures or something, you can get a referendum on the ballot or whatever. So as the case may be, It is an embarrassment for Guaido. It is an embarrassment for Washington. It is an embarrassment for everyone who have supported this charade. Now, the Venezuelan people, I'm absolutely convinced, as you know, I was the first UN rapporteur to go on official mission to Venezuela in 21 years. And I had the opportunity of speaking with the opposition, with the National Assembly, with the cameras, with professors, with the churches, etc. And I had a pretty good impression how the rule of law functions in Venezuela and where the problems are. Now, the mainstream media is telling everybody that, of course, it is a dictatorial regime, that it is a despotic regime, that there are massive human rights violations, that there is a humanitarian crisis. My personal observation is that the economic crisis is the direct result and the direct consequence of illegal unilateral coercive measures and a financial blockade. So you want to fix the problem in Venezuela, lift the sanctions, let Venezuela buy and sell like anybody else. Interestingly enough, Tuesday this week on the 25th, we had the Human Rights Council, which is in session, looking at the third periodic report of Venezuela. And this time around, I was pleased to see that there were quite a few states that had positive things to say about sure. Venezuela. Interestingly enough, even not only Iran, of course, Iran spoke favorably about Venezuela, but Saudi Arabia did too. And so did Nigeria and, of course, Nicaragua and some of the others. So I think that the tide is turning.
All right, let's bring in Arnold August, who's with us on the line from Montreal. Mr. August, in your opinion, does the opposition have any legitimacy left in Venezuela?
Well, in fact, their latest attempt to try to get a new election, a recall election against President Maduro, completely backfired against them. And rather than being for them an impetus to further develop their regime change policy against the Maduro government, fostered by the United States and its allies such as Canada, it backfired. The recount, the recall attempt actually confirmed by a wide majority that the a legitimate president of Venezuela is President Maduro. And I have some good news of the countries that voted against the recent proposal by Venezuelan's minister or foreign attaché to the United Nations, Samuel Moncada. Actually, the vast majority of people, of countries, you would never guess how many, 89% of the 89% of the population represented by their respective countries voted in favor of recognizing Maduro, and only 14 or so voted against it, which is equivalent to around 10% of the population. And since yesterday, there's some more good news. The very few countries that voted with the U.S., such as Australia, Brazil, Canada, Colombia, one of them being Honduras. Now, yesterday, Honduras, when the new president was formally established in Honduras, one of the first things that she did was to reverse the former regime's support for Guaido against Maduro and instead recognize Maduro as the legitimate president of Venezuela. So the 15 or so who voted against it has already dwindled to 14. So this is very significant, and I think it looks very good for the future of the Bolivarian Revolution and the last couple of years of President Maduro until the next elections take place, I believe, in 2024.
Mr. Desaias, let's open up the scope to the entire region. Historically, the U.S. has always had a meddlesome hand in Latin America. Now it seems to be on a quest again to weaken leftist governments in that region. Help us better understand what it is that Washington is worried about.
Well, we have the term exceptionalism, and we have the claim that all of Latin America is our backyard. We have the Monroe Doctrine, which of course is totally obsolete, but in any event, we still act like if we were in the 19th century. And we claim that we can interfere in the internal affairs of states. This is something that the United States has done in Mexico and in Guatemala and in El Salvador and in Honduras, etc. I mean, the United States was behind the coup d'etat against Zelaya in Honduras many years ago, and it's really the one, shall we say, joker in this affair. Now, obviously, if you do allow kind of a democratic election, then you're going to have what happened with Xiomara Castro, who got elected by a landslide in Honduras. I mean, possibly that might not have happened under Trump. I would imagine that U.S. aid and the National Endowment for Democracy would have mounted something against Xiomara Castro so that her victory would not have been possible. So the United States now has lost Chile. Chile has gone to the left. So the United States will probably lose Brazil at the forthcoming elections. And I would hope that for the, shall we say, social rights of the Latin Americans and for the rights of the indigenous, so there will be improvements in store. But unless you lift the economic sanctions, unless you lift the financial blockade, it's going to be very, very tough for countries like Nicaragua and Cuba and Venezuela.
Arnold August, Latin America's political left is making a resurgence, potentially changing regional dynamics. How does the U.S. expect to confront the rise of leftist governments in Latin America as these governments are regaining ground?
Yes, they definitely are regaining ground. As I just mentioned, as we speak and do this show, yesterday they formally lost another ally in Honduras. So I think they're in a very difficult position. Of course, they act with the usual arrogance and bravado, and saying, just asserting that Latin America is the front yard of U.S. rather than the backyard, as other presidents have said before, such as Donald Trump. And so they are in a very difficult position. I think that they will definitely try to undo the election of Xiomara Castro in Honduras, because there are some differences within the ruling party there, try to create some differences there and perhaps try for a slow coup against Xiomara Castro. But whether that can work, I don't know. But we know for sure that they are very much concerned and looking forward to how they can intervene in two major elections taking place in 2022. One is in Brazil, where the Lula, according to the current polls, is bound to win the elections, and that will be a major shift, a major tectonic geopolitical split shift in Latin America, where Brazil, as you know, because of its size, its population, relative wealth, etc., will definitely take a very strong stand in support of further regional integration and close ties with Brazil, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Honduras, etc. So how will the U.S. try to interfere in Brazil to stop that from happening? And I would just like to mention one other example that's taking place in 2022, and that is the elections in Colombia, where as well polls seem to show that the candidate that is against the current Iván Duque political party is also favored to win there, which would be another major shift because, as you know, Colombia is a very close ally of the United States. The United States even has military bases in Colombia, and it is its main launching pad to try to subvert the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela.
Mr. Desaias, let's draw some comparisons with what's happening in Ukraine at the moment. Moscow has hinted that two can basically play that game by bringing up the possibility of Russia sending military assets to Latin America if the U.S. and its allies do not curtail their military activities on Russia's doorstep. Just to review, a top Russian official has refused to rule out military deployments to Cuba and Venezuela if the tensions continue to escalate. Unpack that scenario for us, if you may.
Well, that is within the prerogatives of sovereign states. So if Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela want to welcome additional Russian military presence in their countries, that is their sovereign right. So there's no violation of international law here. Where you do have a problem now in this Russia-United States conflict is the fact that Zelensky in Ukraine wants to upset, or shall we say, this Minsk agreement, which essentially respects the right of self-determination of the Russian-speaking population of Lugansk and of Donetsk. What you probably don't know is that I was the representative of the SD for the elections in the Ukraine back in 1994. I crisscrossed the country, I went to Crimea and whatever, and it's quite clear to me that this is an issue of self-determination and that this has to be dealt with in the Security Council now that on the 1st of February, Russia assumes the presidency of the Council. There you have to discuss all issues under the United Nations Charter, in particular the sovereignty of the countries, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, as I mentioned, but also this overarching obligation of all countries to negotiate in good faith. To the extent that the United States is being intransigent, to the extent that NATO continues its saber rattling and continues threatening Russia, well, it's clear that that is contrary to Articles 2, Paragraph 3, Articles 2, Paragraph 4 of the UN Charter, and that now can be discussed in the Security Council next week because Russia is going to be in the chair. And China has already come out and said that they consider the two proposals that Russia aired in December with regard to a modus vivendi with the United States and with NATO, China considers them to be reasonable, and I have read them. I consider them reasonable, too.
Arnold August, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov just recently told the State Duma that Moscow traditionally maintains close and good relations with Latin American countries, and the number of Moscow-friendly countries in that region has been on the rise lately. Russian influence in Latin America, that sounds like a viable response to the U.S. and NATO's activities close to Russian borders, doesn't it?
Yes, I was a bit surprised, but pleasantly surprised, to hear the Russians' statement. I won't say it as a warning. Well, it is, to a certain extent, a warning that if the United States continues to try to provoke a conflict, a war, in fact, against Russia over the issue of Ukraine, then Russia is essentially saying, well, how would you like it if we sent troops to Cuba and Venezuela to help defend themselves against any possible incursion by the United States and these countries? Of course, these countries, they did not confirm that this option is taking place, but I personally think it's a very good thing that this issue of tit for tat, that is, you're attacking us in Ukraine, okay, we're going to station troops or help the defense in Cuba and Venezuela, which, according to you, is in your own backyard. So I think that is important that this discussion is taking place on the international scale so progressive peoples, governments, progressive governments can weigh in and support any alternative that Russia is proposing to the international community, that this be taken seriously. And this perhaps will help push the United States in thinking twice with regards to their very aggressive action against Russia under the pretext of Ukraine.
Alfred Desais, we're short of time. Very briefly, if you may, coup attempts, threats of military intervention, self-appointed presidents, the attitude and stance hasn't changed regarding Venezuela over different U.S. administrations. In your opinion, what's the end game for the U.S. when it comes to Venezuela?
Well, they will continue. They will maintain the sanctions, will continue the pressure in the hope that somehow the population will collapse. But as you know, I was the rapporteur, the first UN rapporteur to go to Venezuela in 21 years, and I spoke with the population, all levels of the population. And I assure you that the United States lives in its own world and completely misjudges the temperature of the people in Venezuela. The masses in Venezuela blame the United States for the economic situation, for the scarcity of medicines and foods, etc. And notwithstanding, and the Venezuelan population does recognize that and respect that, consider that notwithstanding these sanctions, Venezuela has come out of the COVID crisis better than almost every other country in Latin America. It is way down on the WHO list, has done far better than the United States. You realize that they only have something like 192 deaths per million population, whereas we in the United States have more than 2,700. So if look at the comparison, Cuba is doing very well, but who is doing bad in Latin America? Brazil under Bolsonaro. Who is doing bad? Colombia. Who is doing badly? Ecuador, etc., etc. So this, shall we say, socialized system of medicine and this priority of the government of Maduro to protect the population and to get 95% of the population vaccinated. Well, I think that has to be recognized. And by the way, it was recognized by many states at the Human Rights Council this week during the UPR.
Very well, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, lawyer, writer, historian, and former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred Desais, joining us from Geneva. And thanks to author and journalist Arnold August, who is with us on the line from Montreal. And also special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the years after the U.S. pledged to invest in human rights and rule of law, the Pentagon spent millions training elite Mexican units how to fight, says Ryan Devois Ryder in an article published under the heading, U.S. Military Training in Mexico Increased as Human Rights Waned, New Database Reveals. Stay tuned for more.
Thank you.
families in the Mexican state of Tamaulipas were left reeling last week after a federal judge released from custody 12 members of an elite U.S.-trained special operations unit accused of kidnapping their loved ones. According to the families, the Mexican Marines orchestrated a wave of terror during their six-month deployment in the city of Nuevo Laredo, just across the border from Laredo, Texas, that resulted in at least 47 abductions in 2018. The bodies of 19 victims were later recovered, some bearing signs of torture. 25 people remain missing, including a teenage U.S. citizen. The youngest of the victims was a 14-year-old boy. Drawing international condemnation, the disappearances in Tamaulipas are significant, not only for the acts of Mexican Marines are accused of perpetrating, but also because the Marines, as an institution, have been the U.S. government's most trusted drug war ally in Mexico for more than a decade, receiving extensive training, operational support, and praise from the U.S. military and law enforcement agencies. A new database released this week provides the most detailed picture to date of what the U.S. government's relationship to the Mexican Marines has looked like on the ground, revealing the extensive tactical training that the Pentagon has provided to the Marines elite units and other elements of the Mexican military. Launched by the Mexico Violence Resource Project at the University of California, San Diego, the database allows the users to search through more than 6,000 instances of U.S. military training for Mexican security forces spanning nearly two decades and totaling nearly $144 million in U.S. taxpayer funding. According to Michael Lesiori, a managing editor of the Mexico Violence Resource Project and lead analyst and designer of the project, the data drawn from annual Pentagon and State Department reports to Congress reveals that tactical and lethal training for Mexican military units, especially the Mexican Marines, by the U.S. military has increased substantially over the past decade, while human rights instruction has sharply decreased. One hand is saying we are building up the justice system and the civilian police, and on the other hand is saying we are making your military really good at killing people. Lettieri told Intercept, adding, I don't know that it's an incoherent foreign policy, but it's certainly a slightly deceptive one. Last month, top officials from the U.S. and Mexico met to discuss replacing the Merida Initiative, a $3.5 billion aid package that has been the public face of U.S.-Mexico security cooperation since 2007, with a new bilateral security framework. More than 300,000 people have been killed in Mexico since former President Felipe Calderón deployed the military in a stated war on drug trafficking in 2006. More than 100,000 others have disappeared. Security forces at all levels have a well-documented history of systematic human rights abuses. In 2011, the U.S. and Mexico agreed to a reorganization of Merida that would strengthen law enforcement institutions, enhance criminal prosecutions and the rule of law, build public confidence in the justice sector, improve border security, promote greater respect for human rights, and prevent crime and violence. The shift was seen among some close trackers of the U.S.-Mexico security relationship as a potential move away from the militarized drug war model that has fueled unprecedented levels of violence and instability in the country. And the database complicates that picture. Significant chunks of Merida spending have indeed gone to civil society programs in Mexico in the past decade, largely through the U.S. Agency for International Development and the State Department. However, the government's own records show that the Pentagon has taken the opposite track since 2011, doubling down on tactical training while moving away from human rights instruction. While the database captures the language proficiency and technical training courses one might expect to find in a binational security partnership. It also features extensive records of recent and large-scale training operations involving U.S. personnel in Mexico, including dozens of unit-level pre-deployment training missions involving upward of 140 Marines at a time, combat shooting courses, martial arts courses, airborne parachute courses, tactical driving courses, asset interdiction courses, aerial warfare courses, and more. The top line story that everybody is giving, all the Merida spending is going to justice reform, and it's not just about shooting the baddies anymore, Littori said, adding, I would say what a Pentagon is doing is hear how you shoot the baddies. Information in the database, first organized by Security Force Monitor, a Columbia Law School project, shows that from 2007 to 2012, the U.S. provided tactical training to an average of 261 members of Mexican security forces annually. After 2012, that number jumped to 1,454. The Mexican Marines were the primary beneficiary of the explosion in training, representing nearly 60% of the Pentagon's students and receiving nearly half. That is $46.3 million of the $101.2 million spent post-2011. From 2013 to 2019, while tactical training was surging, the Pentagon provided human rights training to just 27 students, only 12 of whom came from the Mexican military. Combined Pentagon and State Department funding on human rights training post-2012 came out to a mere $212,000. Lettieri went into the project neither searching for nor expecting to find the post-2011 increase in tactical training. But as he continued to work with the data, the shift became clear. When you look at it over time, it just jumps off the page that it's tactical, he said. It wasn't just the Marines, known in Mexico as a SMEAR, receiving tactical training. He discovered the army known as SEDINA also received extensive Pentagon support at a tactical level. The finding was significant because Washington has couched its embrace of the Marines as allies in the drug war in Mexico in the perceived unreliability of the army as a trustworthy partner in matters of operational security and human rights. SEDINA has long been one of the Mexico's most powerful institutions. It has also been tied to many of the country's worst state crimes, including the 2014 disappearance of 43 college students in the state of Guerrero. The database provides just one glimpse into a much wider world of security exchanges between the U.S. and Mexico, Lettieri said, most of which is inaccessible to the public. It does not include, for example, information on the enormous array of arms Mexico purchases from the U.S. or where those arms ultimately end up, nor does it reveal anything about the extensive training and cooperation that occurs between state and local law enforcement agencies on the two sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. Thanks to the joint State Department and Pentagon report on foreign military training that's delivered to Congress each year, we have some ability to understand this section of U.S. interaction with Mexico, Lettieri said. Still, he added, there is a whole bunch of stuff we don't know very much about. That's the key takeaway here. There is a whole bunch of money being spent, but we don't have even this minimal kind of accountability.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.